KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Mid-30s.
To paraphrase Shakespeare, there are more books, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your bookstore.
Lighter would signify awakening to the light within oneself, to open to one's divine identity.
So it's an important time of year, but it's a difficult time of year because, not just because of consumerism, I mean, we're all part of that, but as my brothers will tell you, it's not fun not to be a Christian this time.
How other faiths, and all of us, those of no faiths, those of many faiths, those of one faith, deal with this time of year. Maybe deal is the wrong word. Listen, learn, and adapt to this time of year. We're taking that up. We'll also hear from Nancy Pearl again this hour on weekday on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. She's going to rebroadcast from a few weeks ago her favorite books of 2012, maybe to help you last-minute shoppers. We're going to review the news of the week as well after 10 o'clock. But we start with Husky Stadium. University of Washington Huskies face the Boise State Broncos in the Mako Bowl this Saturday in Las Vegas. Meanwhile, the new $250 million Husky football stadium is being built. When it was announced and finally put into place, it was announced that it was being built with private funds. But as is so often the case in this modern world, there is a public cost. Curtis Eichelberger is a reporter for Bloomberg News, the author of Men of Sunday, How Faith Guides the Players, Coaches, and Wives of the NFL. Curtis Eichelberger, thanks for joining us.
Steve, thanks for having me on.
You know, Men of Sunday, How Faith Guides the Players, the Coaches, and Wives of the NFL, they're probably thinking about that faith a lot this time of year while they have this holiday and they have to still go to work.
Well, it's an exciting time of the year, I think, for everybody. It's a person of faith, not just football fans, but certainly the members of the NFL that are faith-based, Christians. It's certainly a special time.
Yeah. All right, well, you took a look at the funding of Husky Stadium, and you found that though we say it's being built with private funds, there are some public costs. Let's first just break that down a little bit. What are some of the public costs you have found?
Well, it's in the bigger scope of things, this really kind of plays into what we're seeing, happening nationally, where as a country we're trying to figure out what we should be paying for, what we should be subsidizing. And it's not exclusive to the University of Washington. All of these college stadiums that are being built and the new revenue streams that are coming along with them are all being subsidized to some degree by the federal government, taxpayers from Seattle to Hagerstown, Maryland. And what we found here is that, for example, the $200 million is being financed through the sale of municipal bonds. And what happens when you sell a muni bond, when the investors buy them, they get interest. But that interest, they don't have to pay federal taxes on that. So that's a big savings to them. And of course, the higher income bracket they are, the greater the savings. So we calculated that, and the savings over the course of 30 years, of course, the bonds is going to be about $28.5 million. The $50 million that they raise privately, of course, that's usually 100% tax deductible, and assuming the highest income tax rate, because you're not going to have, obviously, poor people donate towards the $50 million. You're going to have the wealthier people make those contributions. The federal government will forego about $17.5 million on that. And then one of the new revenue streams, the school, will be increased donations for season tickets. What happens is you have nicer seats, you have suite areas, you have club seats, and they'll charge you a certain amount of money for the season ticket for the five or six games. And then they'll say to you, in addition to that, if you want to sit in the better seats, you have to make a quote-unquote donation. It's really not a donation. It's really the price of the ticket. You got to pay the ticket cost, the face value, and then also make a donation. And, of course, the donation goes up the better the seat. Well, that donation is 80% tax deductible. And it's worth noting that we did some research earlier in the year, and we looked at 34 public schools in the FBS, the largest division in college football. And those 34 schools collected $467 million in these quote-unquote donations that are tied to your season tickets. So it's a lot of money. And if you look, there's 120 teams in the FBS, and more than that can get these donations. So it's quite a bit of money. When you calculate that, at the University of Washington, the hit to federal taxpayer is going to be about $3.6 million a year. Over 30 years, you're looking at $108 million. So the federal government will forego about $154 million in taxes, which obviously subsidizes the cost of building the stadium and the cost of these donations and the support that goes to the athletic department. And this isn't just the University of Washington. This is every university that collects these donations, that builds stadiums, that uses muni bonds. It's a national issue.
Yeah, and this is over 30 years, that $154 million.
Right, right. And that's the case with every school. I mean, if you look at Washington, they actually did a really nice job. I think it's a pretty well-run program. They don't charge athletic fees like most schools do. There's not a whole lot of subsidy coming from the university like most schools. They run a pretty successful program most years. They're going to the third consecutive bowl game. Their Olympic sports are fairly successful. They run a decent program. But even the programs that are run, what we would consider, you know, well-run, they're still getting the subsidy. And so the reason we bring this up is because, you know, it's one of those things now that we're asking ourselves, should municipal bonds, for example, which were created to help cities and counties and states build roads and bridges and infrastructure because it reduced the cost. It passed some of that cost on to the federal government. But in recent years, they're being used to build malls and amusement parks and stadiums, both college and pro. And President Obama's questioned at one point or another whether or not we should relook at the use of municipal bonds and whether we should take it back to the original use of infrastructure. That would save the federal government quite a bit of money. But it would make things more expensive for, you know, folks like the guys at the University of Washington who gained an advantage and got cheaper financing to build the stadium. So these are some of the issues that, as a nation, we need to ask moving forward. Should these donations, which are really the price of a ticket, should they be a tax deduction of 80%? So there's thousands of deductions like this in the tax code, and these are the things that you're seeing Congress kind of work through, not very well right now, but they're working through them to try to figure out what is it in the broader context do we want to subsidize? What should the federal taxpayers be paying for? Should Maryland taxpayers be subsidizing the construction of Husky Stadium, the renovation? Should Seattle taxpayers be, you know, subsidizing the Dallas Cowboys Stadium?
Yeah, that was a brilliant summation, because that is exactly the question, isn't it? That is what Congress has to grapple with. That's what we have to grapple with, because there is some public good that comes out of these other structures or these other systems. Charitable donations, charitable tax deductions that get us certain museums and certain other institutions, but all of them do have a price, and we should understand with transparency what that price is.
And if you look at it, I take another step as it relates to college athletics. These tax breaks fuel what is often referred to as the arms race, because it essentially gives the schools additional money to build nicer stadiums, to pay more for their football coaches, to higher salaries. If you didn't have the municipal bonds available to you to build this stadium, it would cost the university more. And you couldn't have, I mean, it's going to be a beautiful stadium when they're finished, and everyone's going to be happy with that. I've walked through the stadium. I've seen it. It's going to be just terrific. And everybody feels good about that when they open it. But you would likely have to scale it down a bit. You couldn't build, I wouldn't say the University of Washington stadiums, the Taj Mahal, but I've seen some that are. You'd really have to pull back on some of that. And in terms of the write-off for the donation, for the season tickets, well, if you couldn't charge quite as much for the donation, you wouldn't have as much income, you wouldn't generate as much income, and you might have to tighten up your budget. Having these deductions only gives more money to the universities to then go out and spend to compete with other schools for more recruits. It just ratchets up. It escalates college athletic spending across the country. And it's more beneficial to the richest schools because the tax breaks mean more the more money you're bringing in. So there's this chasm that grows between the top-notch schools, the Texas is the world with $150 million in revenue, and the smaller schools, the average school in the FBS, makes about $35 million in revenue.
This is great context, Curtis Eichelberger. I really appreciate it. You can read Curtis Eichelberger's article on the cost of Husky Stadium. We've got a link posted at our website. Curtis Eichelberger is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's also the author of a book, Men of Sunday, How Faith Guides the Players, Coaches, and Wives of the NFL. Thank you, sir, and Merry Christmas to you.
You too, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:15. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. We have clouds and 40 degrees in the U District. Forecast calls for rain or snow this morning, tapering off to just rain later today, the high in the low 40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, the low in the mid-30s.
Support for KUOW comes from the Low Income Housing Institute's Urban Rest Stop, providing laundry, shower, and hygiene services in a clean, safe environment for homeless men, women, and children to help end homelessness. Downtown and U District locations. Information on ways to donate or volunteer at urbanreststop.org.
This time of year, Christmas lights add more color to the night. Candle fires are lit. Hanukkah is often called the festival of light. But major religions of the world use light to represent big ideas as well. The Interfaith Amigos have been thinking about religious meaning of light. Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary. He's adjunct faculty member at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon, he's a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality and founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Bet Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And Pastor Don McKenzie, former minister, head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle, all come in to talk to Katie Sewell about the light, these interfaith amigos. When did you talk to them?
Talked to them yesterday afternoon.
Talked to them yesterday afternoon. And I wanted to talk to them about the symbolic meaning of light in their different faith traditions. But I also wanted to talk about what it was like to not celebrate Christmas when you're surrounded by people who are celebrating. But I started out with the conversation about light and what it means to them. Pastor Don McKenzie answered first.
Well, I think probably it symbolizes the same thing that it does in other traditions too. But basically, light points to the ability to see more clearly, in order to help with growth, with spiritual awareness. And I would say that for me as a Christian, the ministry of Jesus basically is a ministry of pointing to light. And this time of year, the consumer aspect of Christmas really eclipses the substance of what's being born, which is yet another opportunity to access the light that can actually bring healing. So it's an important time of year, but it's a difficult time of year because, not just because of consumerism, I mean, we're all part of that, but as my brothers will tell you, it's not fun not to be a Christian this time of year.
Jamal?
There are many verses in the Quran that says again and again that God is the light of the heavens and the earth. And the Quran also says that God is outside of you and inside of you. So in the context of the birth of Jesus, peace be upon him, light here would signify awakening to the light within oneself, to open to one's divine identity. And, you know, Muslims believe in the virgin birth. Jesus, peace be upon him, is revered as a very noble prophet. And Mary, peace be upon her, has one whole chapter dedicated to her. And it's an idiom in Islamic spirituality that one of our sacred mission in this world is to give birth to our inner Jesus, to our higher self. And the many words and verses in the Quran that symbolizes, for example, the Quran says Mary suffered birth pangs, meaning to give birth to this light, to our inner Jesus, is hard work. And so Mary went to a desolate place, and suddenly a tree came to life, offered her dates. Magically, a stream appeared at her feet, offering her water, meaning if you start this work, God will help you. So please do this work of awakening to your inner light. Give birth to your inner Jesus. That's a very profound Islamic spiritual idiom.
Inner light meaning what precisely?
Meaning the real you, the light of God in you. We have our personality. We also have our higher self. The Quran says the breath of God. And our work in this world is to align our personality, as a Christian, for a Christian I might say, with your Christ nature, Elohim nature, with your Allah nature, with your Buddha nature. You might say to your soul.
Ted, Hanukkah is the festival of lights, right?
Hanukkah is the festival of light. It's over for this year already. In Jewish tradition, light is the very first creative act. You know, the first creation is light, and that light is created prior to the sun or the moon or the stars, which lets us know that that light is not that kind of light. It's the light of awareness. It's the light of consciousness. And so when we talk about light, we talk about enlightenment. We talk about being illuminated, illumined. We talk about that light which allows us to open to the fuller nature of our being and allows us to see more clearly who we are, who the other is. So to bring light, to celebrate light, is always the way.
And it has nothing to do with the physical lights that are around us, lighting the candles or the Christmas lights or these sorts of things.
In my tradition, we light candles all the time. You know, we light candles at time of passing, when somebody's died. We light candles on the anniversary of a death. We light candles every Shabbat. We light candles for Hanukkah. We light candles for festival. And every time we light the candle is a reminder of the light we carry within ourselves. Every time we see the light outside, it helps us remember the light that awakens in the heart as love, the light that awakens within the mind as wisdom, the light that awakens within every cell of the body as health, as vibrancy.
I'm speaking with the three interfaith amigos, Rabbi Ted Falcon. We also have Imam Jamal Rahman and Pastor Don McKenzie here. I want to move slightly away from the idea of light to talking about what it's like to be outside of the massive culture that is Christmas. As you said, Hanukkah is already over. And although a lot of Americans think that Hanukkah is a big holiday in Judaism, it's not, right?
It's not one of the major holidays, yeah.
For you, Ted, how does it feel to be surrounded by Christmas at a time that's not one of your biggest seasons?
You know, when I was
seasons?
Growing up, what we used to do on Christmas was we would go to a Chinese restaurant to eat, and we would go see Disney movies. Of course, Disney movies aren't what they used to be. And a lot of Chinese restaurants are now run by Christians, so they're not as open on Christmas as they used to be. So now it becomes more of an issue. But it's, for instance, one of the things that Jews do on Christmas is sit in for Christian workers so they can celebrate Christmas if they have the kind of job where somebody can take their place. Members of my community always did that. Essentially, though, there is an aspect of Christmas which is intensely religious, and there is an aspect of Christmas which is intensely spiritual. And the difference between religious and spiritual is that religious is confined to a particular group. It's institutionalized. Spiritual is, by its very nature, inclusive. So from my point of view, I want to be available for the celebration of the light, the celebration of birth of light, that is the spirituality of Christmas time. So increasingly, I enjoy that. But in terms of the specifics, you know, both, in Jamal's tradition, in Islam, Jesus is part of the tradition. But in Judaism, even though Jesus was Jewish, like his Jewishness is part of my tradition, but not his Christian character.
What about you, Jamal?
Yes.
Your calendar rotates year after year, so sometimes in the middle of winter you're as caught up as we are, and other times you're not. So.
But you know, in most Muslim countries, Christmas is a holiday. Why? Because it is a day of happiness for Christians. And in the 7th century, when Prophet Muhammad had this little mosque, he would invite Christians and Jews to do their religious services in the mosque, because he would say it's simply
a place dedicated to God.
Consecrated to God. That's right.
I'll get it. Just a matter of
so time. Based on that, Muslims actually will wish Christians happiness for that particular day. Some Muslims feel that they don't want to really have anything to do with Christmas because they believe that if they wish happy Christmas, they are also agreeing with the fact that Jesus is the Son of God, whereas in the Quran, he is a very noble prophet. But for the majority of Muslims, they really are happy to celebrate with their Christian brothers and sisters the joy of the birth of Jesus, who is so revered in the Quran.
It's interesting for us on weekday because we, now Amina Al-Sadi is one of our producers, and of course we just went through Ramadan with her, recently went through all of it. But at the end of Ramadan, you're busy buying presents for your friends and family, and she was running out to go shopping in the afternoon, and most people aren't aware that that's ever going on for you. Can you explain a little bit more about how it feels, I guess, to have the culture at large not understand that you have similar activities?
Are you saying Muslims would feel isolated?
Yeah, or just that here we all know, know Christmas is going on, but yes, a lot of Christians would not know that at that point of the year, that's what you guys are doing.
Yes, well, basically, a lot of Christians don't know that it's not a national holiday globally. They believe that everybody celebrates Christmas. This is a misconception Christians have. And so they cannot quite understand why other religions would not be also celebrating. And this just comes from a lack of spiritual literacy or religious literacy. So in that sense, some non-Christians feel isolated because they cannot participate with the same fervor, with the same spirit in that religious holiday.
Don,
no, but are you aware that when you're celebrating the Eid after Ramadan?
Yes, or after Hajj. Uh-huh.
Or after the Hajj,
yes,
that the majority culture
uh-huh.
is not really aware that you're doing that. They're not aware of how important a day it is.
Oh, definitely, because, you know, it is a minority in this country. But I must say that more and more as the years roll by, there's more media attention. There's more education in the schools, and more people are becoming aware of religious holidays besides Christian ones.
Right.
So, for example, on Eid, there'll be a huge prayer in the convention center and many other centers, and this is given wide publicity. So I think this religious literacy is increasing more and more.
Do you find that to be true, Ted, for your faith as well?
We lived in Los Angeles prior to moving to Seattle. We've been here almost 20 years. And one of the first things I noticed was the absence of Jewishness and the absence of the high holidays in the press and in the media in Seattle. It was striking, you know, because Los Angeles, like New York, has enough of a Jewish population that Jewish holidays are known. They're part of the culture. In New York City, the public schools closed down on the Jewish high holidays because so many teachers are Jewish. Up here, there are kids who have trouble getting excused absences for the Jewish high holidays, you know, as if the people didn't even know it. So it is different. Just the whole identity of being much more of a minority here is more striking.
Don, I wonder how it's changed your perspective as a former minister, retired minister now, and having formed this friendship with these two, how it's changed your perception of Christmas, if at
all.
I
think it's deepened what they've just been describing. You know, I mean, I wish I had a nickel for every sermon I preached called The Real Meaning of Christmas. You know, it was one of those Lake Bobegon moments, like Pastor Enqvist. And yet I got so tired of trying to explain this over and over, that the substance of Christmas is different, not totally different from the generosity that's expressed in gift-giving and so forth. But my experience with Rabbi Ted and Imam Jamal has deepened that sense, first of all, of what it might be like, what it might feel like to be on the margins of something so prevalent in the culture, so noisy even, so chaotic sometimes too. But it's also helped me to see the meaning of light in Christianity much more substantively. In fact, I've become aware that in my tradition, the Free Church tradition of Protestantism, Congregational United Church of Christ, when I was ordained 42 years ago, Advent, which is the Christian season we're in now, right up before Christmas, was really not celebrated. People started singing Christmas carols in December. You know, the season was December. But about 30 years ago, I remember instituting the season of Advent in a church where I was serving, and we didn't sing Christmas carols. We sang Advent carols, and people were very upset. And we started lighting Advent candles so that there was more light each Sunday. And I think that was a way of starting to recover that sense of light that we were talking about earlier, that is so central, enlightenment, as Rabbi Ted said, so central to each of, not just our three traditions, but all spiritual traditions. Enlightenment is what it's all about. And we can forget that so easily. So I've been helped by them, and by that, this time of year, by the season of Advent, really helping that to prepare me for the moment of the birth of Jesus, which is really the birth of another way of developing a consciousness that's so crucial for the world.
That's Pastor Don McKenzie, who's a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. We're also here with Rabbi Ted Falcon, a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality, and Imam Jamal Rahman, who's co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary. Something you touched on talking about Advent is the role of anticipation in all of our different backgrounds in these different religious holidays, the delay, the waiting for the big day. What do you think is the value of anticipation when it comes to Christmas?
Well, I think it's a chance to wake up, to grow, to be patient. It's delayed gratification. Instead of having the noise spring forth suddenly after Thanksgiving, we have a chance to learn once again what it means to approach the light, to appreciate the whole idea of light, and in my case, of course, what Jesus' ministry meant regarding light. You know, the first verse after the Beatitudes is, "You are the light of the world," pointing to humanity. And what does that mean? You know, how do we make use of that reality that appears in with different words, but in the same way in each of my brother's traditions here? So, yeah, I think that's it.
How about you, Ted? Do you have something to add?
Prior to the major holidays in the Jewish year, there are technically lead-ins, so that before Passover, not only is there time to clean up the whole house and rid the house of leavened products, but the Shabbat before Passover has a special name and has a special character, and they're building up to it. The same thing is true before the high holidays. We don't have something like that leading up to Hanukkah, but nevertheless, in American culture, Hanukkah is when we give presents. That wasn't the case until this country, but then it wasn't the case in most Christian families either until the American experience and consumerism built up. I think preparing for something is sometimes more fun than actually getting there. But the preparation allows us to attune ourselves and to focus so that we have an ability to be more present in the moment. Sometimes I need to remind myself that the preparation itself is the moment. So not to discount the preparation and think it's not happening now, but it's going to happen, but to allow that celebration to unfold for the entire process.
Jamal? And Islam also, like Brother Ted said, there are lead-ins, there's an advanced time, there's an anticipation, and that is a period where a Muslim commits himself or herself to purify oneself, to really be worthy of this particular celebration. So the work is on, as we say metaphorically, polish your heart so the face of Allah is reflected in it. Or if you want to put it differently, to do the work, like Rumi said, at all times, particularly at these times, he said, marry your soul, meaning align your personality with your soul. That wedding is the way. And as you do this work, that wedding day becomes so much more celebratory.
From an interfaith perspective, what should this season be about for all of us together?
We would wish for everyone a reawakening of that which is of true value in human life, in the life of our planet. We would hope for a rededication to love and compassion, kindness, a reaffirmation of the essential dignity of every human being and of all life.
And also to be grateful for all our blessings.
And also I would say, Katie, that the difficulties and the sufferings that we experience, the children in Connecticut, the wars in the Middle East, the fiscal problems, don't have to be. I mean, spirituality is a tool to help change those kinds of things. And that, in fact, is a light in that kind of darkness.
Pastor Don McKenzie is former minister, head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and the Beit Alif Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at the Seattle University. Thank you all three for being here.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekday.
Coming up next, Nancy Pearl tells us about her favorite books of 2012. Stay tuned.
Extend the season of giving by donating your used vehicle to the KUOW Vehicle Donation Program. Call 1-866-KUOW-CAR. Your gift will support KUOW while providing you with a tax deduction for 2012. Call 1-866-KUOW-CAR.
We have clouds and 40 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high reaching 43. It's going to be cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, the low in the mid-30s. Tomorrow, cloudy, rainy, and breezy, the high in the low 40s.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, the National Rifle Association is famous for its tough stance in favor of gun rights. But did you know it was inspired by the radical left?
The NRA mimicked many of the policy positions of the Black Panthers, who viewed guns as protection against a hostile government disrespectful of people's rights.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 6 o'clock.
You knew that if you listened to the conversation we had with the local Black Panther activist who wrote a book about his time with Huey Newton and the gang, the Black Panthers, if you're a regular listener to Weekday. If you are as well, you know who Nancy Pearl is. For you last-minute shoppers, we re-air our conversation we had with Nancy Pearl a few weeks ago about the books of the year and the wonderful gifts they would make. Nancy Pearl is a regular commentator on our show and also on NPR's Morning Edition. She also hosts the Seattle Channel program Book Lust with Nancy Pearl. When she was here, she had a list. I asked her to start.
Well, for nonfiction, the top of my list is Tim Kreider's collection called We Learn Nothing, Essays and Cartoons. I think not enough people know about this book, and it is a fabulous collection of personal essays by a guy who was a political cartoonist all during the Bush years and has segued now into essay writing. And there, even though he's a totally different demographic than I am, there was something in every one of these essays that I would say, wow, that's just how I feel. And the essays range from everything from how hard it is to be grateful for your life every moment of the day, even after you've had a close-to-death experience. This guy, Tim Kreider, was stabbed in the throat with a stiletto on vacation, and it missed his carotid artery by, under an inch. And he thought after that, knowing that he might have died, he would be grateful for the rest of his life for being alive, and how hard it is to do that, to a visit to a Tea Party rally that he and a friend did, to a wonderful section of reading out loud Tristram Shandy to his mother.
What else?
Tim Weiner's Enemies, History, A History of the FBI, which is Tim Weiner did last year, a couple years ago, did one on the CIA, and the CIA one was just fascinating. Well, I think reading about the CIA is just really interesting, and certainly there's been a lot more written probably on the FBI, but Tim Weiner's book, for anyone who's interested in both history and I think in current events, Weiner is a writer to read when you're thinking about either the FBI or the CIA. So that was another good one. Will Schwab's The End of Your Life Book Club. Now, that's such a hokey, when I saw that title, when I got a copy of that book, I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to read this book. I hate being manipulated. I hate that feeling of the author, sort of making you, sort of giving you a subject that you're going to just weep over. I hate that feeling. And that sort of mawkish sentimentality that shows up in books like this. Which, and I just avoid them, but this book.
Why did you expect that mawkish sentimentality?
Well, The End of Your Life Book Club.
I see. That's the whole,
how could it be anything but that? But it is. It's just, again, maybe, one of my top 10 books of the year. But
really?
Yes.
Katie talked to that author.
Yeah, she
really liked it.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I remember when Katie said that to me. It's just a book that, it's a wonder. It's not even the books part that I liked best about this book. The books that he and his mother choose to read as she's getting her radiation and chemotherapy treatments for a very fast moving, lethal form of cancer. But it's really a tribute to his mother, who was seemingly just a wonderful person concerned with issues of immigration. The last thing that she did before she died was make sure that these libraries were being built in Afghanistan, raising money for that. I mean, she's the kind of woman that I remember. I just felt like I wanted to either, I wished that I had a mother like that, or that I was a mother like that, a woman like that. She's just an amazing person. So, this is a book I would say I wish they had chosen a different title. I don't know that there is a better title that I could come up with, but a fabulous, fabulous book.
That's great. All right. Now, I'm going to bounce back and forth because I'm curious about this. So here's a Slate's list of their best books of 2012. And I was wondering if, for example, their top one, I assume it's their top one, maybe not, Young House Love, 243 Ways to Paint, Craft, Update, and Show Your Home Some Love.
I know.
It's the top of their list. I don't know if it's their favorite one. It's their designer chose it, so maybe that's why.
Yeah.
Ever heard of that book?
No.
How about?
But that's not my feel.
How about How Children Succeed by Paul Tough, the Emily Bazelon, who's their senior editor, chose that as one. An education writer, Paul Tough goes deeper than anyone I know, she says. I'm just throwing these out there because find this interesting. Oh, here's Andy Bowers, who was the executive producer of their podcast, used to be an NPR reporter, chose The Man Without a Face by Mesha Gessen about Vladimir Putin.
Well, yeah.
There you go. I'm just tossing them out.
Well, there's something for everybody.
Something for everyone. All right. And look, somebody liked their columnist, Simon Doonan, liked Martin Amis's book, Lionel Asbo, State of England.
That's interesting. I mean,
I read that book.
Oh, you did?
I interviewed Martin Amis for that.
You did?
I don't know if I'd call that one of my...
your top books.
I don't know if I'd call it Martin Amis's latest chuckle fest, a fabulous and much-needed antidote to the twee downtown Abbey view of England. Well, that's true. that's how this writer put it.
Steve, you and I always have a chuckle fest on this when we're on the show, when I'm on the show with you.
We are lower and trashier than any Cardassian or Jersey Shore habitué. That's what we learn about the Brits in that book. That's what this person says. Do you have Nicholson Baker's book?
No.
On your list, The Way the World Works?
No.
Writing on Wikipedia is like John Updike on Ted Williams or James Baldwin on Going to Church in Harlem, a perfect match of subject, mind, and matter. There you go. Okay. I'm just throwing out a few. I'm going to go to some other lists, too.
I'd love to hear about what people think.
What else do you have on your list of best books of 2012, Nancy Pearl?
Okay. One of the books that's on my list is Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth. And I would not call myself a devoted fan of Ian McEwan. I kind of pick and choose what I liked and didn't like, but I thought this book was brilliant.
Really?
Was brilliant.
What was Sweet Tooth about?
Sweet Tooth is about a young woman who's recruited by MI5, and in the course of that, of her work for the MI5, she meets a writer who MI5 is going to subsidize because they want... This is set in the 50s, and so it's winning the hearts and minds of the British people away from communism.
Ah.
But the construction is brilliant.
In what way?
Well, it's one of those books that, again, you can't talk too much about, but I have to say that it's the most like... People who read Atonement and you know, that sort of shock when you get to the end of Atonement, there's a similar shock when you get to the end of Sweet Tooth.
Huh. The New York Times likes this book.
That book?
Yeah.
Do they?
Yeah.
What are their five? I haven't read that second.
Oh, they're not, however, in their list.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
And they're all. The New York Times is... top 10 books of 2012 in this particular list, so it's 5 and 5.
Right. So I bet one is Anne Applebaum's book on the Cold War, the destruction of Eastern Europe.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised, but let's see. Okay. No, not in their top five.
Oh, okay.
No, for their nonfiction, their top five, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Catherine Boo's book about Mumbai Undercity. Did you read that book?
I did read that book.
I like that book.
I like that book, too. It's hard with books like that because I don't know. Evidently, everybody who's read it, most of the people who've read it, believe that it's crossed the line from really superb reportage to something other, deeper.
You don't mean in terms of advocacy, do you?
No. I mean in terms of message and I'm not entirely convinced that it did that for me.
Oh, I see. Well, what would be, is there an example in your mind of a book that has done, that's hard to conjure up out of the blue? But
I think From Beirut to Jerusalem, the Thomas Friedman's book, which is also now out in a new edition. They bring it out every time something comes up in Israel or in the Middle East. So there's a brand new edition of that. But for me, that moved beyond the reportage to a deeper understanding of the context. And much as...
Sort of reframed it, didn't it?
Reframed it.
It did reframe our thinking about it in the West, anyway.
Yes. There's an older title. I'm going to Bosnia.
Are you?
Yes, in the middle of January.
That sounds like the time to go.
I know. Yeah. They said, we won't have you fly into Sarajevo because that airport is frequently fogged in. So you'll fly into Zagreb in Croatia and we'll pick you up.
Are you doing some work? An event there?
I'm going to work there. Yeah, for the U.S. Embassy. there.
Really?
Yes, they're doing. This is really, I think, pretty amazing that they're sponsoring it. If all Bosnia Herzegovina read the same book, and the book is Sherman Alexie's part-time, you know, the diary of
no
a part-time
kidding.
Indian.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, and I'm going to teach the leaders of the discussion groups how to talk about difficult issues. So Bosnia is much on my mind. And there was an older book by a guy named Peter Maas, M-A-A-S-S, called Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which is about Yugoslavia breaking up. And that's a book that, for me, went beyond reporting.
Interesting. What other fiction do you have, then?
Well, Louise Erdrich's The Roundhouse, which won the National Book Award.
Really?
Yes. This is a sequel of sorts to A Plague of Doves, which came out the year I was a Pulitzer Fiction judge, and this was one of our three finalists, The Plague of Doves. And I thought it was certainly one of the top three fiction works for me that year. And again, I am not like this huge, you know, sort of tongue-hanging-out fan of Louise Erdrich. But this book is just remarkable. It's a wonderful novel.
All right. What else do you have on your fiction? That's good. From 2012.
Richard Ford's Canada. Another amazing book. Just an amazing experience. The kind of book that you just read passages and reread them, because he's a wonderful writer. I was surprised this wasn't one of the finalists for the National Book Award.
Well, has he won twice?
For The Sports Writer, that trilogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still,
yeah.
This is a different book.
Remind us what Canada was about.
Canada is about, they're all about middle-aged men.
Yes.
A middle-aged man who's looking back on the life of his parents who were, and his experiences with them, and his parents were kind of failed, spectacularly failed bank robbers.
Yeah. He ended up in Canada.
Canada.
He was a 12-year-old when he started the story.
Right.
I mean, the character.
The character, right.
Richard Ford's Canada. What else? I'm going to go through all your before we...
Okay, Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter.
Oh, yeah.
You know, oh, my goodness.
Spokane.
I mean, of course, one of my all-time favorite books is Citizen Vince by him, and I still think that would be a great gift to give anybody. But the thing about Jess Walter is his last couple... I mean, he's writing very different books each time, and I just give him enormous credit for that. And Beautiful Ruins is set partially in Italy, partially in Hollywood, the way that the past defines who we are in the present, and yet the differences that it is, and again, just some characters in there that you feel like, oh, they'll be around and they'll hang around in your life forever.
Yeah, yeah, including the woman.
Oh yeah, yes,
the mystery woman,
and then there's just two really little known books. And I don't call my list ever the best books. I call them, these are just my favorites for the year.
And that's better.
And that's better, I think, because best books, that's a hard, I would have a hard time, I couldn't defend any list as best. Lydia Netzer's Shine, Shine, Shine. Oh my gosh, what a wonderful first novel. And it's about a brilliant a guy who is on a space mission. It's set in the present. His wife is pretending that she's this kind of upper middle class woman. And then something happens and all of that gets stripped away. And it's about relationships. Again, it's about the past impinging on the present. It's just wonderful. It has a great cover. Shine, Shine, Shine. Do that one. And then Heft, which is on my list for one of the ones for Morning Edition by Liz Moore. And this would be a great book club book. All of these would be great for book groups, actually. But a really good question to start with for discussing Liz Moore's Heft, which is now just out in paperback, is what's the significance of the title? Like, why is it Heft? It's true that one of the characters in this book, the first character that you meet is this recluse who is morbidly obese, So there's partly the heft. But what else does heft mean?
A conundrum we leave you with. Nancy Pearl, author of Book Lust, on her favorite books of 2012. We have that list posted at KUOW.org.
And now, the sound of the day.
Our bicycle correspondent, Willie Ware, recorded this sound on the back roads of Pandaya, Myanmar, as he rode through farmlands. The land was a mix of yellows and greens and browns against a brilliant blue sky. And it was there that Willie encountered a group of men threshing grain. He pedaled over and parked his bike next to large piles of recently harvested rice and wheat. The sight of a Westerner trudging across the field sent the men into waves of laughter. Later on, the men gave Willie a lesson on how to thresh. He says he still needs to do a lot of work on his technique. You can see a picture of those men hard at work at our Facebook page. Search for Weekday on KUOW. Read more about what Willie's doing and with his wife, Kat Mariner, at Yellow Tent Adventures. Nick Bond, what is the adventure for the weather?
Well, today we're getting some more showers. We've heard that before, right?
Yeah. A few times, yes.
Yeah. And it does look like kind of showers at times over the weekend. Temperatures continuing to be a little bit on the cool side in the low mid-40s and at night in the low to mid-30s. Some folks are asking me about, of course, the prospects for snow around here, especially on Christmas Day. And there, I guess I have a bit of an apology.
You do? You have to fall on your sword a bit?
Yeah, well, Marcy asked me last week whether there was going to be any snow around, and I answered in the negative. And while we certainly didn't get blasted with any major snowfall, there was some spots south and north of Seattle and higher elevations that got a noticeable amount. So, again, don't tell anybody, but sometimes our forecasts aren't spot on.
I've heard that. I've heard that, too. What is that? So, but you, does that mean you still don't really know for next Tuesday?
Well, there's actually a small possibility that we'll have something like a repeat of what we've seen this past week. It looks like it's going to clear out to an extent on Monday, and especially if we get a clear night on Christmas Eve, there does look to be another system coming in Tuesday morning. And so if the timing is just right, we might actually get a few flakes around here. It's not going to be a crippling snowfall, and it's much more likely in the North Sound. But still, you know, there's reason to hope.
How about this cold and wet rain we've been getting? Is that continuing?
Oh, well, yeah, we're definitely kind of on in a cool, wet pattern. Next week, it probably won't be quite as wet as it has been. It looks like California is going to get all the fun and games in terms of the weather, but we're going to continue to get showers at times and the low snow levels, and so the ski areas should get their snowpack, you know, freshened up from time to time, but not some of the real big dumps that we've been experiencing.
Nick Bond is a climatologist. He's Washington State's climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with a weather outlook on Fridays. All right, so you had an interesting statistic here. The highest sea level on record in Seattle occurred on Monday?
Yes, that's true. 14.51 feet above mean sea level, for what it's worth, and that's the highest we've ever been measured here. And what's kind of interesting there is all the previous times it's been above 14 feet, it's been during El Nino when the water is overall a higher level due to its being warmer and just the winds and so forth. And we can't really blame El Nino this time. And so it's kind of a harbinger of what we're going to be seeing more of. Sea levels are coming up. And so, unfortunately, this sort of thing is going to be happening more and more often. We're also going into kind of a peak in a very long period tidal cycle that just raises sea levels a bit, too. So, unfortunately, for those folks along Alki and some of the places that were impacted, might be seeing more of these kinds of events.
All right, sir. Have a very happy holiday, a very Merry Christmas, and we'll talk just as we're gearing up for the new year.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist. All right, we shall review the news of the week and consider what this weekend will bring and the following weeks. Stay with us.
It's coming up on 10 o'clock. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's, where donors...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.